Pushkin. A year into the First World War, British soldiers are being sent to fight in Gallipoli, in what's now northern Turkey. 500 men from the 1st Battalion of the 7th Royal Scots have boarded a train in Edinburgh, Scotland, in the middle of the night. It's taking them south to Liverpool, England, where a ship is waiting to carry them to the front. They haven't been told where they're going, but they have been issued with sun helmets, so it's not hard to guess. It's an old train. The carriages made from wood and lit by natural gas, stored in tanks underneath them. It shouldn't really be in service anymore. Modern trains are made from steel and lit with electric, but this is wartime. One of the soldiers is 18-year-old Peter Stoddart. We were full of expectation. Through the night we chatted and played cards. But Peter and his friends aren't going to make it to the bloody battlefield of Gallipoli. Many won't even get to England. I'm Tim Harford, and you're listening to Cautionary Tales. Quintin's Hill is a railway junction, just on the Scottish side of the border with England. There's a signal box and four tracks. The two tracks in the middle are the main lines, one going north into Scotland, one going south to England. And off to the side of each main line, there's a loop of track where slow trains can be parked and wait while faster trains can go by. Inside the signal box are rows of great mechanical levers that the signalmen throw to operate both the points that allow trains to switch from one track to another and move brightly coloured signal arms up and down the tracks that tell the train drivers to stop and go, a bit like traffic lights on a road. Signalman George Meakin had been on the night shift at Quintin's Hill. At 6 in the morning, he should have handed over to the day shift signalman James Tinsley. Meakin and Tinsley were friends. They'd been doing shifts in this signal box for years, and they had something else in common. Neither enjoyed getting up early in the morning. So they'd agreed, between themselves, that whoever was on the day shift would sleep for a bit longer and come in at around 6:30, not 6 o'clock sharp. For Tinsley, this arrangement had an additional benefit. It meant he could sometimes come to work on a slow local train. Usually that local train went straight past Quintin's Hill without stopping, but sometimes the northbound express train from London to Glasgow would be running late, and that took priority. The slow local train would pull off the main line onto a loop at Quintin's Hill to let the express train go past. That morning, May the 22nd, 1915, James Tinsley hitched a ride to work on the local train. It arrived at Quintin's Hill at 6:30. George Meakin, in the signal box, had to get it off the northbound main line to make way for the delayed express. But he couldn't put it on the side loop because that was already occupied by a freight train. That happened sometimes. So Meakin switched the northbound local train onto the southbound main line. He could sit and wait there instead. The local train ground to a halt. Tinsley hopped off and went up to the signal box to start work for the day. He'd brought the daily newspaper and handed it to Meakin. Meakin handed Tinsley the notes he'd made on a scrap piece of paper about everything he'd done since 6 o'clock. Tinsley would copy them into the official logbook in his own handwriting so it would appear to their superiors that the shifts had changed at 6 o'clock, as the rules said they must. "Right, mate. Here's the situation," Meakin says. "There's a goods train on the northbound side loop. We've got to clear the northbound main line for the express. So I've parked your local train on the southbound main line, as you know. There's an empty coal train going south, and I'm sending that to to wait on the southbound side loop. And the next train that'll want to come south is a troop train. Got it? Well, have you got it? Back on the troop train, the soldiers have started to drift off to sleep. The train rumbles south. It approaches the village of Kirkpatrick, 4 miles from the border with England. The track starts to slope gently downwards, and the train begins to pick up speed. At Kirkpatrick station, there's another signal box. An empty coal train has just passed Kirkpatrick, going south. At 6:34 a.m, the signalman at Kirkpatrick learns from Quintin's Hill that the empty coal train is no longer on the southbound main line. It's been safely moved onto the loop. He assumes that means the line is clear for the troop train, but he has to check. And this is a time before radios and telephones were widespread. Messages are sent by a telegraph that rings alarm bells. At 6:43 a.m, he asks Quintin's Hill, "Can I send the troop train through?" "Yes," comes the reply. "The track's clear." But of course, it's not. The local train, the train that brought Tinsley to work, is still parked on it. The signalman at Kirkpatrick doesn't know that. He watches the troop train hurtle past. Researchers who study workplace safety sometimes make a distinction between work as imagined and work as done. The idea is that what's written down in training manuals and rule books and operating procedures might not always correspond to what employees actually do in practice. The railway rule book, for example, says that the night shift ends at 6 o'clock precisely. As we've seen, that's not what happened at Quintin's Hill. Meakin and Tinsley routinely swapped at around 6:30 instead. But they had to hide that from their superiors. So at 6 o'clock, whoever was on the night shift stopped writing in the logbook and switched to a scrap of paper instead. The logbook can't tell us who sent that signal at 6:34 to say that the empty coal train had left the southbound main line. Meakin will later say he's sure it was Tinsley. Tinsley thinks it must have been Meakin. No wonder neither of them can remember. They know that whoever sent that signal should have followed up with another signal to tell Kirkpatrick that the southbound main line was nonetheless still blocked, now by the local train. But nobody does. The levers in the signal box correspond to the tracks, the main lines, and side loops. The rules say that when a track is blocked, the signalman puts a ring or collar on the lever as a visual reminder. Some even say, "Train here," in big letters. That's work as imagined by the rule writers. In practice, Meakin and Tinsley didn't bother with it. That's work as done. Whenever a train stops for more than a few minutes, the rules say someone from the train has to visit the signal box to remind the signalman they're there, check there's a collar on the lever, and sign the logbook to say they've done this. The fireman from the local train signed the logbook, but he didn't check for a collar. Who uses those? And he didn't feel the need to remind Tinsley that the train was there. After all, Tinsley had only just got off it. If you imagine that work always happens exactly as the rulebook dictates, it's hard to see how any signalman could forget about a train on the line. When you look at how work was actually done, it becomes less inexplicable. Here's another example. According to the rules, the staff from the trains shouldn't stay in the signal box for a moment longer than necessary to exchange critical information, so as not to risk distracting the signalman from his duties. In practice, they might naturally hang around for a chat. When Tinsley gets to the signal box, The brakesman from the goods train is there. The rules say Meakin should leave as soon as he comes off duty. But he doesn't. He settles down to read the newspaper. The fireman from the local train turns up. So does the brakesman from the empty coal train. Meakin passes on the latest news about the war. When Workers Done departs from Workers Imagined like this, whose fault is it? The traditional approach is to blame Workers Done, but rules can sometimes be cumbersome or unrealistic. Eric Holnagel is an academic who studies safety in the healthcare sector. He argues that we should always be keen to close the gap between work as done and work as imagined, but we should keep an open mind about whether it's the rules or the behaviour that needs to adapt. He gives the example of a hospital, where the written procedures say nurses should take blood samples from patients only when a doctor requests them. But nurses routinely take samples from very ill patients before the doctor has arrived. It saves precious time. Should the nurses be reprimanded, or should the rule book be amended? To close the gap between work as imagined and work as done, managers need to understand what workers actually do. And workers need to feel free to be honest. If the railway managers knew that the signalman didn't always use the lever collars, they might have come up with a better system. If Meakin and Tinsley had felt free to ask, "Can we change shifts at 6:30?" they wouldn't have needed their subterfuge with the logbook. Tinsley sets about copying the entries from Meakin's scrap of paper into the logbook. Meakin and the train workers are chatting about the war news. Tinsley hears the signal from Kirkpatrick. Is the southbound main line clear? The lever isn't in the position that would remind him the line is blocked. And he responds without thinking. Yes, the line is clear. The train he arrived on has slipped his mind entirely. On the troop train, 18-year-old Peter Stoddart is jolted awake as he's thrown across the carriage. What on earth is going on? Watching from the signal box, a horrified James Tinsley and George Meakin see exactly what's happened. The troop train has ploughed into the local train on the southbound main line. It was going much too fast to stop in time. The old wooden carriages of the troop train are now scattered zigzag across both tracks. Tinsley and Meakin know what's about to happen too. The late-running London to Glasgow Express is powering up the northbound main line, straight at the debris. It won't be able to stop in time either. In the troop train, Peter Stoddart tries to get up, then tries again. But something is pinning down his left leg. He hears the steam whistle of the express and the desperate screeching of brakes. Then everything goes dark. When Stoddart comes to again, he finds himself halfway down an embankment. I looked up, and there was a little lark singing its damned head off, he remembers. I saw my mate a few yards away. He was laughing like hell at me. I put my arms out to him, and it was only his head. His head with his mouth and eyes open. I broke down and started to cry. I don't know for how long. Stoddart gets to his feet and scrambles up the embankment. It's carnage. There are body parts everywhere. Some soldiers had wriggled free of the troop train into the path of the onrushing express. Many more are trapped, and they can't be rescued because the wooden carriages are burning fiercely. The crash has punctured the gas cylinders, and the hot coals from the steam engine have set the gas alight. 3 railway staff died at Quinton's Hill, and 9 passengers from the local train and the express. But it was on the troop train that the heaviest toll fell. The Royal Scots lost 214 soldiers. Only 83 of the bodies could ever be identified. The Scottish court took the traditional approach. They blamed the workers, not the rules. They found that work as done was entirely at fault. Meakin and Tinsley were found guilty of culpable homicide. Both spent a year in prison. But when they got out, the railway company gave them jobs again. Perhaps the bosses knew, deep down, that their own rules had also been to blame. It's always easy to find fault with work as done. But work as imagined had played its part too. For a list of our sources, see the show notes at timharford.com. Cautionary Tales is written by me, Tim Harford, with Andrew Wright. It's produced by Ryan Dilley, with support from Courtney Garino and Emily Vaughan. The sound design and original music is the work of Pascal Wise. Julia Barton edited the scripts. It features the voice talents of Ben Crow, Melanie Gutteridge, Stella Harford, and Rufus Wright. The show also wouldn't have been possible without the work of Mia LaBelle, Jacob Weisberg, Heather Fain, John Schnars, Carly Migliori, Eric Sandler, Royston Beserve, Maggie Taylor, Nicole Morano, Daniela Lacan, and Maya Koenig. Cautionary Tales is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review. And if you want to hear the show ad-free and listen to 4 exclusive Cautionary Tales shorts, then sign up for Pushkin Plus on the show page, in Apple Podcasts, or at pushkin.fm/plus.